Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you, even though I can't see you. I am not with you this morning because I'm in Duluth, Minnesota. Our youngest daughter, Jamie, is running the Grandma's Marathon there. And that's all I know at this particular time. I'm doing this on the stage at Heritage Landing just for fun. I decided I wanted to do it here. When I was just a few years ago, in fact, I saw some pretty interesting concerts here. I saw Aerosmith here. I saw Buddy Guy. And right where I'm standing right now was Alice Cooper. I saw an entire Alice Cooper concert here about 15 years ago. So it's kind of a cool place. I thought I'd like to be able to share a stage with them. It's kind of an interesting time. Now, I wanted to start off today by talking about this wedding. You know, Jamie got married about 6 weeks ago or so. And I remember finding out that she was on her way. You know, I was 43 years old. I was sitting in my office upstairs here, and what was going on was the phone rang. And whoever was secretary at that time buzzed me and said, "Hey, your wife is on line one." And I thought, okay, she never calls when she's at work, and she was at work. So what I did was I picked up, and the words that she said shocked me. You know, because I was figuring she was going to tell me I had to go to the school because one of the kids had gotten in trouble or something. We had four kids at the time. But what she said was, "Sherwin, I'm pregnant." Kind of freaked me out. But like I said, we were 43 years old, stable marriage. Both of us had good jobs. So we thought, yeah, we can handle this. Well, Jamie was born just a few, 8 months later. And we kind of got used to the fact she was born on Diane's 44th birthday. Now, as she was growing up, she noticed that there's a 10-year gap between her and her sister, Julie, the next oldest one, and she's kind of curious about that. And then she's about junior high age, middle school age, she figured out that she was an accidental birth, an unplanned pregnancy. So she came up to me one day and she goes, "Dad, I realize I'm not supposed to be here. I realize that I was a mistake." How do you respond to that? I responded by saying simply, we always make the best of our mistakes. We didn't plan you, but God did, and you have been a blessing. See, God always finds a way to make the best of our mistakes, and His plan is always better than our plan. No matter how big a mess we've made, God finds a way to redeem. He is in the restoration and redemption business. Now, have you seen that in your own life? Have you seen it where God makes things turn out better than you could imagine? You make plans, things don't happen the way you plan them, and a better solution comes along. The question is asked, many times by folks, how do you make God laugh? Well, you tell Him your plans, because He has a better way. Not that you're going to live without trouble. None of us do that. But trouble will be a part of your growth process. When you work with God, He turns your scars into stars. God does His part, we do ours. It's not always easy, but as one of my mentors said, it takes guts to get out of the ruts. Now, we're dealing with Ruth here. And Ruth was one gutsy gal. In Hebrew, she's called a Eshet Hayal. Literally means woman of valor. I say it means woman of grit, woman of moxie. She went from being a foreigner, a widow living on scraps, to becoming the great-grandmother of a king. Now, she had been in the land of Moab. She was a Moabitess. And she married this Jewish fella, and he died. And her father-in-law died. So she came back to Bethlehem with her mother-in-law. while she was gleaning there, while she was going through the fields getting the scraps, she met a fella named Boaz, and they hit it off. Let's look at chapter 4. Boaz went to the town gate and took a seat there. Just then, the family redeemer he had mentioned came by, so Boaz called out to him, "Come over here and sit down, friend. I want to talk to you." So they sat down together. Then Boaz called 10 leaders from the town and asked them to sit as witnesses. And Boaz said to the family redeemer, You know Naomi who came back from Moab. She is selling the land that belonged to our relative Elimelech." The town gate where they went was where all the legal transactions were made. It's kind of like the courthouse. And he got witnesses because, well, he was going to make a proposal. The land that Naomi had belonged to her deceased husband. She had gone to Moab because of a drought. There was no crops there. Now she was back, and the land was apparently yielding again. Passage goes on. "I thought I should speak to you about it so that you can redeem it if you wish. If you want the land, then buy it here in the presence of these witnesses. But if you don't want it, let me know right away, because I am next in line to redeem it after you." The man replied, "All right, I'll redeem it." So he would have to pay market value for the land. But the drought was over, so the price was likely up. He wanted the land. Story continues. Then Boaz told him, "Of course, your purchase of the land from Naomi also requires, get this, requires that you marry Ruth, the Moabite widow. That way she can have children who will carry on her husband's name and keep the land in the family." See, the land had to be transferred because women were not allowed to own property in those days. The widow, along with the property of the deceased, came with the land. So literally, if he married her, he would inherit a farm. He had to marry the daughter-in-law, whose husband was the heir to that property. She came with the farm. In verse 6, "Then I can't redeem it," the family redeemer replied, "because this might endanger my own estate. You redeem the land. I cannot do it." Now, he probably had a few wives already. Polygamy was widely accepted in those days. You could have as many wives as you could afford. So he probably just didn't want another one, or he didn't want to make his current wives jealous. We don't know what's behind all that. Verse 7. "Now in those days, it was the custom in Israel for anyone transferring a right of purchase to remove his sandal and hand it to the other party. This publicly validated the transaction. So the other family redeemer drew off his sandal as he said to Boaz, 'You buy the land.'" Now, taking your sandal off is a very strange custom. You know, it's like, okay, I give up here. Let me give you my shoe. That seals the deal. Verse 9, "Then Boaz said to the elders and to the crowd standing around, 'You are witnesses that today I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. And with the land I have acquired Ruth, the Moabite widow of Mahlon, to be my wife. This way she can have a son to carry on the family name of her dead husband and to inherit the family property here in his hometown. You are all witnesses today.'" It's frequently mentioned in the book of Ruth that Ruth was a Moabitess from the land of Moab. Now, according to Genesis chapter 19, the Moabites descended from Lot. You remember Lot. He lived in Sodom. And when God decided to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his wife and his two daughters fled the scene. Lot's wife looked back longingly, and as the story goes, she was turned into a pillar of salt. But Lot escapes with his daughters, and he lives in a cave for a while. While he's in that cave, his daughters get him drunk, and they seduce him. The oldest daughter got pregnant, and she had a son, and she named him Moab. He became the father of the Moabites. So So Ruth has that in her background. She married the Jewish boy named Mahlon, who was the deceased heir of the property that she was on. When Boaz bought the property, he bought Ruth. It was legal. He had witnesses. Ruth here is making the best of a mess. What I find incredible about these stories is that all of these people that were thought of as being heroes of the faith were just like us, except maybe they had a little more grit. Yeah, but their lives were as full of disappointments and nasty things going on as anybody else. Verse 11, then the elders and all the people standing in the gate replied, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, from whom all the nation of Israel descended. May you prosper in Ephrathah and be the famous in Bethlehem. And may the Lord give you descendants by this young woman who will be like those of our ancestor Perez, the son of Tamar in Judah." God said, may she be like Rachel and Leah, wives of Jacob. Now, they were sisters. They both were married to Jacob, who later was called Israel, the founder of the Israeli nation. They had many sons, 12 altogether, with their handmaids. When one of the two of them, Rachel or Leah, wasn't getting pregnant quick enough, they took their slaves, brought them to Jacob, and he got them pregnant. The offspring then would be considered theirs. And then it says, be like Perez, our ancestor. Well, it's true, they were in the land of Judah, and Perez was the son of Judah, one of Jacob's sons that he had through his two wives. Now, Perez was the son, like I said, the son of Judah, and his story is told in Genesis chapter 38. But they had the same marriage laws where, you know, men ruled the roost and women couldn't own property, or that women were considered property. And Judah had this son who was married to this woman named Tamar. Now, what happened was he died. Judah had another son that was in line to marry Tamar, as was the custom. But Judah was putting some roadblocks up for that. He didn't want his son to marry Tamar. He figured that he'd die too. So Tamar had to do what all widows had to do, was basically live with their father as a widow until somebody came along and married him. Well, Tamar was a woman of grit. And what she did was she set up a tent alongside a road as a shrine prostitute. She was working as a prostitute. Now, she set this tent up knowing that her father-in-law, Judah, would be passing by. And sure enough, Judah passes by, stops in, and does business with her. Perez is the result of that encounter. It's kind of weird, but his grandfather was also his father. Interesting story. All these things are in the background of Ruth. So Boaz then, going on with the passage, so Boaz took Ruth into his home and she became his wife. When he slept with her, the Lord enabled her to become pregnant and she gave birth to a son. Interesting that it says the Lord enabled her. She did not have children with her first husband. She went from barren to fertile. God was redeeming the situation. Passage goes on, then the women of the town said to Naomi, "Praise the Lord who has now provided a redeemer for your family. May this child be famous in Israel. May he restore your youth and care for you in your old age. For he is the son of your daughter-in-law who loves you and has been better to you than seven sons." See, because she had a son, because she had a male child, she now had an heir. Passage goes on, Naomi took the baby and cuddled him to her breast, and she cared for him as if he were her own. The neighbor women said, "Now at last Naomi has a son again," and they named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse and the grandfather of David. And as you know, David became king. and David, get this, folks, with all this mess in their background, David was a direct ancestor of Jesus. Now, the Jewish people like genealogical records, so I decided to include that in my presentation today. This is the genealogical record of their ancestor Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Amminadab. Amminadab was the father of Nahshon. Nahshon was the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz. Boaz was the father of Obed. Obed was the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of David. God is into redeeming tough situations. He wants to make our lives better. There's a cool New Testament passage on this, one that I really like. It's from the book of Revelation, chapter 21. It reads like this. I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, "Look, God's home is now among his people. He will live with them, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there will be no more death or sorrow or crying or pain. All these things are gone forever." That's his description of heaven. It shows God's intention to make everything new, to get rid of all the bad stuff. That God's going to live with us eventually, and he's going to eliminate tears and death and pain. All of those things become obsolete. And then he says this in verse 5, "And the one sitting on the throne said, 'Look, I'm making everything new.'" The Lord renews. He is the one who turns scars into stars. He does that when we're willing to participate with him. When we show moxie and grit and work with him, things get redeemed. Now, some of you are facing giant problems right now. You've got endless family issues. You've got struggles in your relationship with your kids. Maybe you've got a recent death in your family. Maybe you're going through a divorce. Maybe you're fighting a mental or physical illness. Or maybe it's just smaller problems that you have, like weight gain or car troubles. Or maybe you made some serious mistakes that have caused much grief. No matter what it is, God is standing ready. Standing ready to be your redemption partner. He does turn your scars into stars. Sometimes redemption happens. As long as we live on this earth, we will have problems. We will make bad choices. Because we're human. We're just as human as Lot, as Perez, as Jacob, as Boaz. God knows this, and he stands ready to be our partners in redemption. So think of your problems, then pray, asking God to show you how to redeem the situation. He will show you, just like he showed Ruth. He's waiting to show you a better way. So join him on the path to your redemption. Well, I want to thank you all for listening. It's been kind of fun standing on the same stage that Alice Cooper once stood on. It's been fun presenting this to you. I'll see you again next week. So greetings from Duluth, Minnesota. And as always, thanks for listening.